We're beginning a new semester, but we're continuing our old series that we started last semester on the Jewish home. When I was in high school, so we had a teacher who was very vulgar, to the point where I would blush just sitting in his class. It was a class in English literature. And in English literature, you can really be very vulgar. So I went to the Rosh Yeshiva, and I said, you know, I don't think it's right in a yeshiva that I should have to sit through such a class. I'm willing to take all the tests. I'm willing to do what I have to do. I don't want to sit through the class. And he listened to my claims. When I was done, he said, go sit in class. And I was very upset at the answer. I tried to argue my case a second time. He listened, and he said, Netanel, go sit through the class. And I said, why should I have to put up with this in a yeshiva? And he said, in life, you're going to have to deal with situations that are not so different from this, and there's nothing wrong with learning how to deal with it and succeeding. So go sit in class. Okay, I didn't have much of a choice. I was sure he would side with me. Okay, so I sat through class. I learned so much more from this experience of being forced to deal with a person who I really had a hard time respecting. Story number two, we had an excellent, excellent math teacher. And then one day I was absent, there was a test. And I was good at math. I had straight A's. And then I come back the day after the test, and she says, why weren't you here yesterday? And I said, I wasn't feeling well. And she said, bring me a note from your mother. And I looked at her and I said, are you serious? She said, yeah. I said, okay, bring you a note from my mother. That day she lost all respect in my eyes. From that day onward, I never participated in class. That was the last day I participated in math class till the end of school. I still got A's, but she never got another answer out of me. Was I right or wrong? I say I was wrong. And I'll tell you why. We allow ourselves in life to have breaking points where we tell ourselves, if the other party wronged me this far, so that's it. It's over. So in my mind, if she's treating me like a baby, she doesn't respect me, it's over. Okay, fine. So I'll do my minimum responsibility. I don't have to liven up her class. I don't have to participate. She'll ask a question. I don't have to raise my hand. She'll have to give me the A anyways, because I'll get 100 on the test without participating in class. She doesn't do anything towards me. I don't owe her anything. Fine. End of the relationship. And that's exactly what I did for the rest of the year. In my book, it was over. But in life, that's not a good idea. Because people make mistakes. We also make mistakes. And people make grave mistakes. We also make grave mistakes. And we have to be forgiving enough to say, even though the other person didn't apologize and doesn't even realize that what they did is wrong, I'm going to take a step towards them and I'm going to make this relationship work. And if we allow ourselves to go the other route, then there's no way marriage can work. Did I tell you the story about the alternative medicine? Yeah? We didn't do it this... No. We didn't do it this semester yet. Okay, I'll tell you the story. It's a true story. Although usually I don't divulge who the parties involved are, over here I'm going to allow... I'll tell you even who they were later. Because they're celebrities, so everyone knows the story. You guys are just a little young, you haven't heard it yet. There was a couple that were happily married, and the wife decided that she's going to dabble a little bit in alternative medicine, and the husband begged her, don't feed me things without telling me. Now you remember? Yeah, we did this. Okay. So she killed him, right? You guys know who we're talking about, yeah? She gave him Adam and Eve, right? She killed him. It's that simple.
What did she give him?
She gave him the forbidden fruit. Chava, Eve. You know, look at the first couple in Tanakh. You know, how are you going to live with her now? Right, I'm saying, you know, that's it. So what do you say now? You say, look, we're human, we make mistakes, and even if the other party has no way to make it up to us, you know, the first year I gave a devastating story, and then for years I didn't say the story, and I think I said it here already, about the wife who didn't seatbelt the kids.
Yeah.
I said the story, right? Because it's a scary story, but you know what? These things happen, and we all make critical mistakes. We have to be willing to forgo it. And one of the ways in which we can actually, we can train ourselves is by behaving a certain way. Do you know that we subconsciously do things that calm ourselves? I'll give you an example. You ever notice people doing this? We have many nerve endings down here just under our chin. And when a person is uncomfortable, so then there's a tendency to touch just under the chin, and that has a soothing effect. We don't even know why we do it. Women have a tendency when they're very uncomfortable, they'll put their hand right here. Right? There's a little groove right there. So they'll sometimes play with the necklace, or they'll touch right there. And that's a way in which a person calms himself down externally. You know that people will sometimes... did you ever talk to someone... You guys have probably seen this, right? Where you're talking to someone and they're like this, or like this. You notice what they're doing? They're hugging themselves with one hand and they're touching their face with the other hand. And there are little things we do externally that we don't even think about, but they really help us. We don't think about them, but they affect us. It's very interesting because you see it on little children. One of our kids has a curl over here that the second he gets nervous, he starts twiddling. So you know he's done something. You know, he walks home from school and he's doing this, and you know something happened today. He's going to say, no, everything's okay. You know, and so when they're little, you can get away with things like... he walked in one day with a piece of chocolate and he's doing this. And he says, Abba, can I have from this chocolate? So I said, it's interesting you're asking me about that chocolate. You already ate from the other ones. So he says, no, I didn't. So I said, if you open your mouth, I'll look into your stomach and I'll tell you if you did or didn't. It's only a hand on his mouth. Now, how did I know? Because he's walking in, twiddling his hair as he's asking. He has no reason to be nervous if he's really asking. But we do little things. We can actually use that to our benefit. Meaning, let's take an example. If someone really got us upset, so we can start yelling. What that does is cause us to be more agitated. What would happen if we'd stop and smile? You know, just smiling causes us to be calmer. We did this experiment here, not last year, I think 2 years ago. I challenged the class, for the next 2 minutes, everyone should put a dumb smile on their face. You don't have to mean it. Just, you know, sit here like this for 2 minutes, and you will see that in 2 minutes you will be calmer and happier. So if you feel stupid doing that, so they say a good way to do it, where's my pen, is you take a pen and you put it between your teeth, I guess, yeah, and you stay like that for 2 minutes, and you will see that you will become calmer, meaning... The fact that you force yourself even to put on a fake smile, you're not doing it. You see, try it. Even a fake smile makes you feel different. When parents tell me they can't help but yell at the kids, I say, try taking 1 half hour. Don't take that half hour when you got to put them to bed. And don't take the half hour when you got to get them out to school. Take a half hour in the day when you're with them, but it doesn't have to be the most pressured half hour. And decide in that half hour I won't yell. Whatever yelling will be either before or after. Suddenly, you find that you were able to deal with so many things without yelling. So by taking an external, something external and saying, I'm going to force that on me, we can actually change our behaviors. We can actually change the way we feel. And that's very important because one of the issues we have in marriage is that we walk into marriage feeling like, I could hack this. I know what it's like to be a friend. And then suddenly you meet up with a relationship that's so trying on your nerves. And before you know it, you find yourself in this cycle of yelling, getting upset. You just walk through the door and you feel your blood pressure going up. There was a woman who went to the doctor and he checked her blood pressure and he said, you know, your blood pressure is pretty low for your age. Are you married? You know, how could you have low blood pressure if you're married? I don't get it, right? So there's a certain cycle that many couples enter and they don't know how to break out of it. And we all have that. We have certain cycles of behaviors that we have, and you'll ask a person, they'll say, but this is who I am. I don't know how to be any different than that. I don't know what to do. I'll quote you a conversation. Okay? Husband says, my wife was working really hard. I wanted to be nice to her. So I made her a cup of tea. I brought her the cup of tea. She looks at me and says, I didn't ask for that. So now the husband says, you know what I felt like doing? Pouring it on her head. She could have said, no, thank you. But instead, she looks up with this steely look and says, I didn't ask for that. Now, what am I supposed to do now? I said, smile. He said, what do you mean smile? What am I smiling at? That's just not fair. Okay. I didn't say she was fair. I think we said this the first class. You can't work with fair in marriage because if we're working with this scale, so then I'll always have reasons why I find that she's not being fair to me and she'll have reasons why she'll find I'm not being fair to her. We have to be forthcoming beyond what's fair. But I want to take this one step further. This idea of we can break a habit, we can change cycles of behavior, and we can actually be warm and forthcoming even when we feel like the other side doesn't deserve it. So our story really begins in the Holocaust, where a woman and her husband were separated, and she had all the children except the baby, and he had the baby. And 4 years later, after the war, the family regroups, but that child is no longer a baby. So the mother said years later that she never felt the connection with the baby like she did with all the other children, because she never invested in that baby like she did in the other children. So you'd think that's the easy kid. Of course, you love him more. No, it doesn't work that way. Connection is built through giving. So if you tell me we're at this juncture where she's impossible, how am I ever going to give her? So you get married, and God willing, your wife becomes pregnant. And it's the middle of the winter, and you want to turn on the heat in the house, and she says, it's broiling here. How could you turn on the heat? So you put on a jacket and a sweater and a coat, and you're drinking hot tea with a scarf in the house, and you're sitting there shivering, and you're saying, you know, honey, could we just turn on a drop? And she says, you kidding? Why don't you put on a fan? And you look at her and you say, you know what? Let's do something objective. Well, look at the thermometer, okay? What's normal room temperature? And you bring out a thermometer. You're a good husband. You know how to work with logic and systems. And she's a good wife. And she looks at the thermometer and says, thermometer's lie. It's hot in here. What are you going to do? Approximately a decade and a half, almost 2 decades ago, there was a handicapped child who didn't have friends. And he had a very hard time making friends. So his mother asked me what I suggest they do. And I said, I think the kid has to start volunteering. So she said, the kid's in a wheelchair. How's he going to volunteer? I said, let him use his wheelchair and go to the neighbors and collect cans for the poor. And if he likes it enough, then let him, we'll start arranging that other children will do it and he'll organize it. And he will make phone calls and he'll arrange the pickup and the delivery. One of the things that I found consistently in education, if you want a child to grow, give him the responsibility to give others. Not to take, to give. Don't give him a tutor, make him a tutor. I've often said, if you know Aleph Beis, so go tutor orphans who don't have someone to teach them Aleph Beis. Very often people say, what do I have to offer? Also, story from a little over a decade ago. There was an old widow who was sitting at home just crying her eyes out. So the family met and they asked me, what do I suggest? I said, we should get her involved with children who come from abusive homes, children who come from broken homes, who don't have someone who could do homework with them. What does she have to do all day? She has nothing to do all day. She's a widow. She has her estate. She doesn't need anything, right? So she's spending her day crying. No, that's not legitimate. If she would be busy giving, then she would have a better life. A month and a half ago, I met one of the people who, I don't know what they call it, he fundraises for many, many different organizations. And he told me that he sees a very interesting thing. Every day he's meeting with another millionaire. He said, you have those people who are busy giving. And when they're busy giving, they have a beautiful life. They can be old, they could be 80, they could be 90, they could be handicapped, they could be in a wheelchair, they could be half senile, but they're busy and they have a beautiful life. Then you have people who reach an old age and they're not ready to give a penny. So I'll go meet with them and they'll tell me how no one wants to talk to them and they'll spend all their time wanting to talk to me, but they won't donate a penny to any of the organizations I represent. And I'm not going to come talk to them again because I see there's no point. And very quickly, their circle of friends diminish and they're left with themselves. One of the things you learn in life is that by giving, you end up liking what you've given to. Just like that mother had a different relationship with the children who she didn't invest in. Just like the handicapped child, if he were busy giving, it's not just because he was busy. Once he becomes busy with giving others, he becomes a different person. And the same is true within a marriage. When we hit a difficult juncture, we have to realize that if we find the way to give, if we find the venue through which we can be the giving party, we will end up loving the other party more. Very often people enter it and say, but that's not fair, why should I? We already said, it's not a question of what's fair, it's a question of how can we make this work. People will sometimes say, I feel like I'm a sucker, I'm a loser. I do the dishes, I pick up the kids, I prepare the supper. So you're doing a lot, right? And you're making this marriage work and you're making the home work. Okay. If it works, it works. And obviously, we hope that both parties will give, but we have to come from a vantage point that says, I want to give. Let me see how I can give. A group of students showed up 2 weeks ago to the other yeshiva that I'm in, and it was during the break, so someone had come into the yeshiva and they had a yahrzeit. It was the day in which a relative had passed a year or two ago. So they brought in these two fancy cakes and they put a sign, when you make a blessing, do it in memory of my mother, whatever it was. So these guests come in and the rabbi tells them, before we sit and learn, why don't you guys help yourself to some cake and coffee? So the guests all go and help themselves duly of cake and coffee. And when they're done, they come to the class, and now they're supposed to travel back to the south, to the yeshiva they came from. The guys go back to the coffee corner, and they start cleaning up. They sweep, they wash, they clean up. They leave the place cleaner than they found it. So the rabbi asks them, you guys don't have to do that. So the students say, hey, we came, we got something. We want to give something back too. We know we're leaving it better than we found it, but we want to give something back. Now, that shows something healthy. That shows us something wonderful about those students. They might not know a lot, but there's something right about the way they were brought up. We're in a yeshiva setting. A person can say, I'll get married, let me see how to implement this. It doesn't work that way. A person has to find within himself how he can take these steps forward. I'm not saying take your life savings, give it to charity. I'm not saying that. You need your life savings. You need to build a life. I am saying that there are venues in which a person can give back. I'll give a small example. You took a drink, you went upstairs, there are 7 dishes in the sink. Right? What would be the big deal if you washed 2 instead of 1? So you washed the dish you used, plus someone else's dish. You did something nice and you don't even know who you did it for. Didn't cost you money, cost you another minute of time. But you've done something for someone. And here, I want us to notice a pivotal point. You know, there are people who take their tefillin out of their tefillin bag, and they kiss them about 30 times before they put them on. I don't know if you ever saw this. It's like it's raining around them before they put on film. You know, I don't know if you've seen this. I see it every so often. Now, I'm a cynic. I try not to be, but I'm pretty cynical. So whenever I see that, I turn away because I don't feel like it's real. You know, you love them so much. I don't know. I love my kids. Do I kiss them like that 30 times? I don't know. Okay. When you think about something that you do, it's very different. The effect it has on us is very different. You know, a person could walk into shul and say all of davening, but he left his soul at the door. You know, he stood here shuckling, he said every single word, but he wasn't here. And then you have a person who walks in and sits down and thinks about what he's going to say, and he says less. He doesn't say all the words everyone else says. He got in less, but he thought about what he was saying. The same is true with washing the cups. You make it into a habit. Okay, you've done a mitzvah. It's good. You have a habit of doing a mitzvah. But the impact is a little less. I started doing something which I found very meaningful. You know, we have a custom. Thank you very much. Thank you. I can't eat now, but okay. The other guys probably would be happy. Yeah. Thank you. We have a custom to give charity before we say Shemona Esrei, right? There's a custom. It's quoted in the Gemara. It's quoted in the Halacha that a person should pray out of doing a mitzvah, and it's customary to also to have that mitzvah be giving charity. So I decided a few years ago that I'm going to give the charity just before I say the words. Let me get a sitter. What is it? Right. So I give the charity just before I say, Tzur Yisrael, Kuma Be'ezrat Yisrael, the Rock of Israel, arise to the assistance of Israel. Why? Because I think to myself, before I ask God to help Israel, let me help Israel. Meaning I'm asking Hashem to arise in our assistance. Have I done anything to assist the Jewish people this morning yet? And you know what? Because I do that, I discovered that I don't know if I ever thought about the charity I was giving beforehand. You know, you come to shul, you know you're supposed to give charity before you daven, so you give, you put your 10 agorot, your 20 agorot. But suddenly when you tell yourself, before I ask God to help Israel, I should help Israel. And then you go back to the pushka, you're about to stand Shemona Esrei. Instead, you walk to the pushka, you put in those same 20 agorot because they involved some thought, suddenly it's a different mitzvah. So there was once a father who came to a famous rabbi and he said, my daughter is so stingy. I can't get her to part with anything. And she has to get married. How will she ever build a home? So the rabbi said to him, I'll tell you what to do. Are you willing to invest 100 shekel in your daughter getting better? The father says, 100 shekel. I'd give 1,000 shekel if I could get her better. So the rabbi says, fine, take 100 shekel, divide it into 1,000 pieces of tenagurot, and tell her that she has to give 30 pieces every day. Every day she has to give 30 times. She has to take 10 agurot, put it in this pushka and that pushka, give to this poor person, that poor person. Tell her, look, it's not your money you're giving away. I'm going to give you, every week, I'll give you your 210 coins, right? So you'll end up giving, what does she give every week? 21 shekel, big deal, right? 210 coins, 10 agurot. Yeah, 21 shekel. Big deal. So every day you give away 30 coins. So every day you'll have given a total of 3 shekel. Very good. Not such a big deal. But it gets a person into the habit. And if you think about it, so then by the time you're done, she'll be a different person. If we think about what we're doing, so then we become different. And the time to start is now. Imagine if... I don't know if you guys had this. I had a wonderful roommate. Really extraordinary. Anytime they'd wash our floors, in Merkaz Arav, they would wash our floors for us. I don't know if you guys have to wash your own floors. You wash your own floors? Huh? So this guy, we'd have to lift the stuff off the floor so they could wash the floor. We knew which day of the week they'd come to wash the floor. So he'd take all the chairs and put them on my bed and on my pillow. And he didn't bother turning them over. He put the feet, you know, all the dirty things that were on the floor, on mine. So I was once like wondering, is he just like, he doesn't notice that the feet of the chairs are dirty? So I decided, I'm going to check. So one morning, I said, you know, the cleaner's going to come today. And I pick up the chair to put it down on his bed. I wasn't really going to do it. I just wanted to see his reaction. And as I'm about to put it down, he comes in yelling, no, don't do that. That's dirty. I said, gee, that's interesting. So you notice the feet of the chair are dirty, right? Interesting. Right? Now, you sometimes have a roommate that you look at him and you say, okay, interesting, right? That's the best word you can use. What do you do when you're faced with such a situation?
You he gets the message.
You'll find that you have scenarios. I once had a guy who I trusted. And after 2 years, I discovered he'd been robbing me blind to the point where he stole my passport, saying, you know, sold it to the Russian black market.
Yeah.
It's pretty serious, right?
How did he get your passport?
I trusted him. He knew where I hid it.
How did he sell it?
What? How did he sell it? I'm not going to tell.
Was it after that that you started growing a beard?
So, no. When I found out, I went to the embassy. I went to cancel it right away. But I don't know how, you know, I don't know when he stole it and sold it. What do you do when you're faced with something that's like not fair? So you can explode, or you can tell yourself, smile. You don't want to smile, but there are habits that we can form. So we're discussing two sides of the same coin. On the one hand, we could change our reactions by forcing something externally. On the other hand, we can acquire good habits. One of the ways to acquire good habits is to think about doing something positive and do something positive on a daily basis. If I think about it and I do it, then over time it will become a part of me. They're two sides of the same coin. We are a difficult generation. We have phones that are called iPhone. We have pads that are called iPads. Everything is about me. We have even Torah, when they sell us Torah, so they create a website called Torah for me. Really? Torah for you? That's very interesting. You know, Torah is for you, but is that really what the focus of Torah should be? So we are a generation that's very focused on ourselves, and it's a problem. It's one of the reasons why our generation has a very hard time having a good home. Building...
Wii. Huh? The Nintendo Wii.
Nintendo Wii, yeah, okay, spelled W-I, yeah. someone said it used to be Rogaloch, and now it became Beastly. At any rate, but that means that we have more to work on. I have one more story to tell you, but again, this one has to go off the record. Okay, I'll tell the story without names. Okay, it's more interesting with the names, but I'll leave the names out of the story. Again, the story goes back many years ago. No, I never told the story before. I don't think so, not in this class. There was a bus... coming, I don't know where the bus was going, but the bus was coming to this neighborhood. I know the parties involved in the story, and they wouldn't mind if I told you, but not on the record. So the bus is coming back, and the bus is full, and it's one of those really crowded buses, like Erev Sukkis, where everyone's coming on from the shuk, and everyone has their wagons, and you guys have probably experienced this by now. And the person gets on the bus, a woman who's in her 50s, you know, that age where you look at them as a youngster sitting in your seat and you tell yourself, they're not that old that I really have to get up for them. And you could sit there and convince yourself that's perfectly okay. They're a little older than your parents, but they're not old enough to have white hairs. You don't think they're going to fall over, but you see they're a little tired from the day. You know, it's that age where you can tell yourself, I'm tired too, and you sit in your place, okay? And a girl gets up and goes over to this woman and puts on a big smile on her face and says, please sit down. And she put on such a warm smile when she said it that the woman actually felt comfortable taking her seat and sat down. Okay, there was a young rabbi sitting who witnessed all of this. And his stop came, and he decided, I'm not getting off. I want to see who this person is who was able to give up her seat with such a warm smile. And he figures, I don't even know where this bus goes. He knew where he had to get off. He didn't know where the bus keeps going, but fine, he... goes another stop, and he goes another stop, until finally, like three stops later, the girl gets off, and he gets off. Now, this is Orthodox people. He's not going to go over and get her number, right? The rest of the story we'll leave for off the record. But at any rate, that's, I think, something which we have to strive for. And it's something to strive for now. And to be able to give with a smile. How often do we get up and offer someone our seat, but we'd really rather be sitting, so we're not smiling. If we get into that habit now, then by the time we get married, we'll have an easier time. It gets harder in marriage. It's not easier. You'd think that the closest person in your life, that would be most natural. It doesn't work that way. What happens naturally is you walk into marriage and you expect, okay, I'm doing mine. They should do theirs. And we have a whole list of what we think theirs should be. And that's not what happens. Not how it plays itself out. So suddenly we have to give beyond what we thought we'd be giving. And that's where that habit of giving with a smile, of saying, I can do this even though I don't feel like doing this, and I can do it with a smile. We can create that habit. The story I told you about the handicapped child, that story happened numerous times. And over the years, now it's been over a decade, I've been able to see those kids who did give and those kids who didn't give. I told you guys the story about the kid I had was a shoplifter. I was teaching a class. What? I don't remember. I was teaching a class, and I get a phone call from the local candy store, and he tells me, you know, I've caught this student of yours already 3 times shoplifting in my store. I don't want to turn him over, but what am I supposed to do? This is the 3rd time I'm catching him stealing candy from my store. So I said, I'll call his parents down. And you don't let him in your store anymore. You know, well, You do yours and I'll do mine. So I called the parents down and I tried talking to them. And I could see where the kid got his bad habits from. The parents were dishonest to me. Even in that conversation, there were things that came up which you could see they were just dishonest. So what do you do? So I was really young. Was one of the first classes I taught. So being very young, I did two things. One was right, the other one was wrong. I'll tell you the one that was wrong first. I said to the parents, you know, I want you guys to start saving money. So they said, why? I said, because pretty soon you're going to have to post bail, so I want you to have it. So that didn't get me anywhere. I was hoping I'd shock them and get somewhere. Okay, I didn't get anywhere with that. But I did something else which did work. I gave him some responsibility. I had him volunteer and help and go bring food to the poor and personally take challahs to people for Shabbos. And that worked. Years later, he was still doing that. He was dishonest in other areas, I know. He did his time. But he was always also giving. So at least we were able to build part of his personality. And slowly, he actually got married and built a decent life for himself. This idea that giving builds a person is true in many aspects of life. It's something that a person should find every day. Before you go to bed, ask yourself, did I do something for someone today? And within marriage, a person should try to challenge himself, where can I give more? Marriages are doomed when people start thinking what I'm supposed to get out of it. Marriages can thrive when the individual, again, don't look at her, look at yourself, when the individual focuses on, where can I give? And even if he brought her that cup of tea, and she looks up at him with that steely look and says, I didn't ask for that. So right now he feels like a dunce. You know, I stopped what I was doing, made her a cup of tea, and she can't even say thank you. Stop, take control of yourself, smile, and figure out where you went wrong and how you'll move forward. It's not what you're expecting. That's true. But all of marriage is not what you're expecting. I shouldn't say all, just most. So you got to be prepared to give in fronts which you were unprepared to do earlier. And that's a habit. And that's a habit you could start with today. So what did we discuss today? We discussed that a person can do things externally. Stroking the beard, touching over here, hugging oneself. There are things we do externally that affect us without us even knowing it. Then there are things we do externally that affect us and we do know it. We can get into good habits. Good habits have more of an impact when we think about them than when we kiss the tefillin 30 times but involve zero thought. Once we get into good habits and we think about them, then with time, they become a part of who we are. A person is very inclined to say, this is who I am, this is the cycle I'm in, this is the way my marriage looks, this is how I know how to behave, I don't know anything different. And that's where a person has to know that that's not so. It's our job to learn to be different. Marriage doesn't work naturally. Naturally, there are explosions. If we're willing to work on ourselves and make it work, then it can be beautiful. The real connection is built through giving to the other person. And even though we won't necessarily get the response we'd like, and we gave the story of the woman in the Holocaust, the handicapped child, the child who was shoplifting in the candy store, the girl who was miserly, there are many stories. As we act, that slowly affects us internally. And I don't know if you noticed, but here we've really gone against much of the Western thinking that says, let your actions express your emotions, and we say, let your actions create your emotions. And it's not my idea, it's Maimonides in his introduction to Pirkei Avos. Maimonides discusses how through actions, through habits, we can actually acquire traits. We're not doomed to the nature we were born with. Through our actions, we can actually get into habits that will change our nature.